the urgency?
A missing person.
Stuart Green. He's back.
He's dead.
Apparently not.
Two men go missing exactly 17 years ago to the day after Stuart Green disappeared. Coincidence, my whore.
You need to stay away from her.
Do you know Megan?
Do you?
Do you know she's changed her name? She is now Megan Pierce.
You're going to keep you and your family safe. How exactly?
These people were last seen within a week or two of each other.
And all the missing men were connected.
Which means...
it's a serial killer.
Ah! I think we get it.
Spoiler.
I mean, to be honest, that whole trailer... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Welcome to Cord Killers, the show about watching the stuff you love when you want, where you want, however you want. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Brian Brushwood, and I swear to God, I'd be perfectly happy if that whole trailer was like, she's dead. No, she's not. Yes, she is. No, she's not.
She changed her name.
Good.
No, I mean, she didn't.
Bryce, were we supposed to make heads or tails of what we just saw?
No, I showed you the back half of that trailer, which already didn't have much information. So that was a trailer for the upcoming crime drama series Stay Close from thriller author Harlan Coben. For people with mysterious pasts have to confront those pasts when someone connected to all of them disappears. It comes to Netflix December 31st.
Heck yeah. I wonder if it's a serial
honestly
killer.
Really intrigued just from the fast dialogue, you know? She's Megan, but she's changed her name to Megan Pierce.
Oh, I thought, oh, that's good.
That's yeah, it doesn't make sense if you don't see the minute of the woman who's leading a second life, but that wasn't very interesting either.
No. To be honest, I would not have this any other way. Hey, man, what's our primary target? No,
it totally worked. I'm in. I'm watching Stay Close. I can't wait for December 31st. Let's get on to the primary target. The term binge watch entered the mainstream around 2013 when the Oxford English Dictionary considered it for word of the year. It didn't win, selfie won. It's some tough competition, but binge watching has become a normal thing. Whether it's on a show's first release, like Netflix, when they give you all the episodes at once, or later after all the episodes are out, after a week-to-week release, like Paramount Plus or HBO Max, people can watch a lot of one series at once. But how do you do it? There are different flavors of binge watching. There's watching all 12 episodes of a season in one night. Then there's watching two episodes a night, maybe over the course of a week. Some people binge watch only on special occasions, like maybe a long holiday weekend. Others binge watch only when the show's really good and they get caught up in it. And for others, it's the default. You pick a show and you binge watch it. TheConversation.com even has an article looking at whether binge watching can become an addictive behavior. They found that it follows other compulsive behaviors. It can be problematic for some people, and usually that's associated with depression and anxiety. But for most people, it's likely not problematic or perhaps even a thing. I've noticed my binge watching declining over the years, whether that's just me getting old or just the novelty wearing off. I don't know. Brian, what's your binge watching pattern?
Well, first of all, I do like that we think about binge watching separately from the way we consider traditional week over week watching. And we have talked about the idea that maybe certain programs or stories get an upgrade by watching them all at once because you don't have to worry about like keeping up with what happened last week, 2 weeks, 5 weeks, 10 weeks, and so on. I like the evolution of language, but the hysteria about whether or not binge watching is good or bad reminds me an awful lot about the hysteria about novels. There's a wonderful podcast formerly known as the Pessimists Archive, now called Build for Tomorrow with Jason Pfeiffer. And he takes all of these things that everybody was all freaked out about, like, is it elevators? Are they making you crazy? Bicycles, opera. And one of them was, I kid you not, about the novel. Kids are sitting there reading all day. Used to be they would come out sensibly, one chapter per week in the local newsletter. But now, all of a sudden, you're reading them at once. What a disasters await. And so I'm not buying even one word of the hysteria around binging being better or worse than the other. However, I am fascinated by what stories benefit the most from binging versus those that do not. Because, for example, never made it through Fringe. Because that was a week over week, 26 episodes per season, hour long per episode, seven seasons. I was like, nope, that is not a binge show. Bryce, you gave up on Lost, even though by all accounts, that's a fine long-term story. Not great for binging because it just goes in circles for 75 years. Right? However, other stories really, really benefit from binging and some don't. Like I tried to go back watching Firefly. Absolutely. The majority of people who fell in love with that property fell in love with it because they binged it, because they only discovered it after it hit DVD. And there was very little of it, and it was all very condensed and very, very tight.
In the proper order, when it had originally aired, it was aired out of the intended order.
Correct. And then meanwhile, I got my kids into Battlestar Galactica, but that was just a case where an hour an episode, it was all just too long. Three, four, five, you know, hours, night after night after night, we just lost it. So I think it's a very culturally significant thing to consider. I think in general, I'm thankful that binging is an option, just like I'm thankful that novels are an option as opposed to weekly chapters or what have you. But I'm hesitant to put any kind of like value judgment on them one way or the other.
Yeah. And I don't even think that conversation article is putting too much of a value judgment, just sort of saying like, hey, looks like there might be some kind of compulsive behavior like other similar stuff. And if you're having a problem, here's some things to think about. But like I said, I don't think most of us have a problem with binge watching. If you do, then great. We've got the link to the article. We'll put it in the show notes. But most of us are probably just using it as a tool to entertain ourselves that we didn't have before. Although I remember the first time I ever can recall binge watching anything was in the 90s. My girlfriend had recorded off of television all the episodes of Twin Peaks and Star Trek The Next Generation. And we would sit and watch her with her VCR, and we would VCR and chill, I guess. Like we would watch all the seasons of Next Generation up to that point, because it was still airing, and all of Twin Peaks. And it felt like a nifty, cool thing that you couldn't normally do. Like, oh, she's got all of the episodes, and we can just sit here and watch one after the other in the evenings. Isn't that super fun? I then also recall, I guess I have a type, because the woman I married, Eileen, and I, one of our earliest fun things was getting DVD box sets, and we would binge Alias, for instance. And I think I've even told the story before about we'd finish a season of Alias and I would get in the car and run to to Borders to see if they had the next season to binge. And so when Netflix came along and started giving you a new series entirely at once, that was the revolution. The revolution wasn't that you could watch an entire series of something. The revolution was, this is a brand new series, and you're going to get the first episodes all at once. You can binge right from the beginning. Now, I don't binge as much as I used to. I think mostly because we watch so many different things that we don't want to give all of our time to one thing. Most of the time, with rare exceptions, we'll watch two episodes of something in a row before we switch to something else. And we may binge in that sense of like, we might watch two episodes a night over the course of a couple of weeks, not every night, and get through it. But it's not, I don't know. Maybe it's because I have to keep more current for the things we do on Cord Killers, but I don't feel like I do the binge watching, like the novelty wore off. I really do think. And it's like, yeah, this used to be super fun, but now it just feels like, okay, that's too much. I need to break it up.
I think I have two thoughts. Number one, oh my gosh, there's nothing like that feeling of realizing that it's getting awfully bright outside and that you've watched a show until the sun come up. You know, that was great. I do think that many stories derive a tangible quality of experience benefit from being binged, of just, you know, keep on going. Oh my God, this is so good. So good. I would guess, and this is pure speculation on my part, but I would guess that at this point in both of our lives, compared to 10 years ago, 10 years ago, there was a lot of really great video hour-long stories that hour-long episodes that we, for whatever reason, had not encountered yet, matches that we had yet to meet. And now, 10 years down the line, there are fewer of those matches, and we have to wait for them to be invented or created. And except for Babylon 5, I'm not watching Babylon 5. Maybe the reboot. But you know what I'm talking about, right? It's simply a numbers game.
Yeah, because the other thing is, as time goes by, those matches fade, right? What would have been a great match in 2008 might not feel as compelling because we've got so much good television, right? The best shows on TV in 2008 are probably maybe in the top 100 best shows now because there have been so many good shows. And I don't know if this is new. I don't think it is, but I've kept up more. I've the shows like Succession that I want to watch will binge to catch up, and then we're on the boat, right? And you have to wait like everybody else for them to come in. So I feel like the binging I do now is more catching up with a show that I didn't start out with, but now I know is good.
So this is a bias that shows up like on satellite radio. When you listen to a 70s, 80s, 90s station, there's an artificial bias because you're not actually hearing the most popular music from those eras. You are hearing the songs that have withstood the test of time and become kind of canonical to that era. You know, you're hearing your Doobie Brothers in the 70s and go on, so on and so forth. I feel like there's some amount of that happening as well. Because, like, for example, I remember personally being blown away when I discovered Buffy the Vampire Slayer, watching all night long pirated copies that had it 320 by 240, like, which is ridiculous now, and watching it till the sun came up. I don't think I could lure any of my children who of ages 8, 14, as I found out, and 17, into watching any of those. But all three of them have binged, loved, and really gotten into Avatar: The Last Airbender, Korra, or whatever. I feel like some stories are battle hardened and withstand the test of time.
Sounds like The Office is one of those with your.
Oh, certainly,
your family
Right? The Office. Everybody's gone through The Office and Friends. I think Josie's now making a lap through Friends, but they've gotten distracted by that League of Legends animated show.
I'm curious what everybody's binge watching patterns are. I think almost everybody does it to some extent. Although I don't know, maybe there's somebody out there who's like, yeah, I don't even binge watch anymore. Even when I watch a new show that's entirely been released, I watch one episode a week. And I just pace myself.
Even as you're saying that, I feel like you don't believe that the person's out there.
Well, I never rule out the possibility that there's somebody out there that does that, right?
Cordkillers@gmail.com is what you're saying.
Yeah. Listen, folks, we bring these kinds of questions to your attention because you pay us to.
Dude, not to make a big deal about it, but you're our boss. And technically, it's your job to call us in for a yearly review, but we're calling you in for a yearly review. How are we doing? Hit us up at cordkillers@gmail.com and vote with your dollars at patreon.com/cordkillers. Keep us loud, live, and independent, bringing you the information that you need to watch what you want, when you want, whatever dang device you please.
Please do. This is the time of the year.
Oh, Tom.
What's the matter, bro?
Oh, God.
What's up? What's going on?
I just got a phone call from my doctor. He said, I have a terrible case of the three digits. I have only three digits where there should be four.
I see. The only cure is six people becoming patrons without us losing anyone. Is that what they said?
Oh, goodness. I'm sorry. You go on without me. I'll just die here by the side of the road with my 996 bosses instead of the proper over 1,000.
We'll get Brian back up off the ground, folks, but it's going to take your help. Please pledge till it helps. If you used to pledge for Patreon and you had to drop off at any point, and now you're back in the position to be able to help us, Brian needs you. We don't want to hear him caterwauling like this either, but you can stop it. Patreon.com/cordkillers. Now, while Brian moans, the rest of us will try to carry on and tell you how to watch. Red Notice is a thing Interpol gives out. That's kind of like an international arrest warrant. But it's also the name of a big, dumb action flick with big stars on Netflix. And it has surpassed Bird Box, a smart, clever, arguably more substantive film, also with a big star, in hours watched. So it means people are, well, watching Red Notice a lot. Red Notice has 328 million hours viewed, in comparison to Bird Box's 282 million. Now, this has a lot of pundits and some people on social media scratching their heads, perhaps bemoaning the fate of humanity. The median is probably just puzzled, like, what makes Red Notice more popular than Bird Box? Well, The Verge's Katie Keck dug into why. We'll have a link to that article. It's a great read. It was up against some competition. Red Notice didn't come out in a dry period. Ghostbusters had a new movie. That 8-hour Beatles documentary was out. But the most compelling argument for why more people have watched Red Notice over Bird Box is that there are more people with Netflix now than when Bird Box came out. When Bird Box came out, there were 139 million subscribers to Netflix. There are now 214 million subscribers to Netflix. So it might be just that Netflix has a bigger pool to draw from. Brian, what do you think? Does that explain it?
Just to make sure I'm wrapping my mind around this. This is the story of a thoughtful meditation with real star power and Hollywood quality movie making that didn't do nearly as well as a by the numbers dumber movie with maybe more stars in it, but still, by all metrics, a worse movie. And yet the worse movie did better than the smart movie, right?
Yes, the smart movie was once the king of Netflix, or queen, and it is no longer by this clearly inferior movie.
So glad we're finally talking about this. You have no idea, Tom. It has been 20 years, and I wanted to talk to you about why Armageddon did better at the box office than Deep Impact. Deep Impact was brilliant. It was an existential crisis. The thought and the sacrifice that happened that went into it, the thought of, like, how do we keep sanity in a world gone mad? It was brilliant. Armageddon was dumb. It was a dumb spectacle vehicle that was poorly written, that I hated with the white hot power of a thousand burning suns. That's what we're talking about, right?
Brian, no, that's not what we're talking about at all. I think you've missed the point here. We're talking about why Dante's Peak was a clearly superior movie than Volcano. And Volcano did way better at the box office for whatever reason.
No.
But no one saw Dante's Peak until it came out on VCR. Why is that? Why is it that the clearly superior movie never does as well? Actually,
Tom,
you know what?
We're actually talking about Vice Versa and Like Father, Like Son. One was a Kirk Cameron vehicle that had Dudley Moore in it. The other had, Fred Savage and Judge Reinhold in it. It was clear. Okay, look, this is a tale of the oldest time.
We're not trying to say Red Notice is the same movie as Bird Box. Don't get us wrong. And what is different here is that Bird Box was the leader, right? It was the greatest movie on Netflix of all time when it came out. And I think people got lured into the idea of, maybe the Netflix audience is a little more discerning. Maybe it takes a slightly more, it's not the best movie on Netflix necessarily. That's Roma, but by gosh, Bird Box is a decent one if you're going to have the blockbuster. And Red Notice ticks all the boxes on, here's what a big blockbuster, like massively appealing movie looks like. And yeah, I don't think it is shocking. It's like, guess what? It's also its most popular movie ever.
To summarize my point, this is number one, a tale as old as time. For some reason, all of these come out in duplicates. As a matter of fact, even my TV show, Hacking the System, the weirdest, most surreal moment was when I got a phone call from somebody at True saying, yeah, we had this idea for a show about scams and cons and hacking your way on top. We'd like you to be a contributor to it. And we're like, that's really weird because I've been out pitching this exact show. And they said, prank call, and then hung up. In one way, this could be a compliment in that it means that the streaming ecosystem has matured enough that, finally we get to have the same arguments that we had about television and movies and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look at the numbers, if I'm doing the math right, the percentage of subscribers of Red Notice, like hour per subscriber, is still larger than Bird Box's. So it, I don't think it's just Netflix has more people watching now. It's that thing you said where it's like, oh yeah, sometimes Volcano and Armageddon just bring more people into the seats, whether those seats are their couch or the movie theater, than the more, you know, sophisticated take. Those are A to B comparisons because they're the same kind of movie, the same kind of plot. But in Bird Box's case, Bird Box also came along when it was like, oh, Netflix can do really good movies too. I remember when Bird Box came out, people were talking about the fact that Netflix had put out a kind of a major motion picture kind of movie, not just a specialty movie. And Red Notice is that times 10, right?
Right. And which was the one that was on Netflix? Was it Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie? Sorry, I mean the Munsters or the Addams Family? Sorry,
well, again,
I mean,
Bird Box and Red Notice aren't the same.
No,
plot,
but I'm going to keep running with this. I'm sorry.
I don't know. What do you think? Are we missing something, or is it just, you know, sometimes people like big dumb action movies?
Whether you like it or not, there's no disputing the fact that star power really matters. And I think that there's massive star power with Red Notice, and that's kind of the alpha and the omega of the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, and you know, Cliff Singer points out we're still in a pandemic watch mode. That could be a little multiplier effect. Maybe not the cause, but you know, that could put a 0.8x on there, you know, give a little boost to Red Notice that it might not have got otherwise. That's a good point. So yeah, there's probably multiple factors there.
Yeah.
CorkKillers@gmail.com if you have got the answer. or at least an opinion. Let's move on to what to watch and Under Surveillance.
Not like real estate. It's all about location.
Under Surveillance.
There's a trailer out for Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, the sequel to the animated Into the Spider-Verse movie. They've added a part one to the title, so they better make part two. Am I right, Dune fans? Huh?
Wait, Dune fans should be happy because they're definitely making part two. Like, who's also upset?
Anyway, the trailer is mostly what appears to be the opening scene, as it pretty much picks up from the end of the last movie with Miles Morales in his room at his aunt's house, and Spider-Gwen in the trailer drops in from the multiverse. Also, side note, how are we feeling about the voice of Kate Bishop, Haley Steinfeld, also being Spider-Gwen? Like,
she was always that voice, right?
She was the Spider-Gwen first. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I like her much, much better in spider form.
Yeah.
People don't say very often.
she's double Marvel canon. So yes. It's kind of fun. Anyway, there's also a tease at some varying animation styles that this movie might have multiple animation styles as they move into different universe. There's definitely a look at Spider-Man 2099, who was voiced by Oscar Isaac, though we don't actually hear the voice in the trailer. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse arriving October 7th, 2022.
Yeah, I watched it because I love this property. I love the first movie so very, very much. It's one of the few movies I saw twice in the theater. It's a blast. It was a little bit like watching a sunset where you know you shouldn't stare directly at the sun, but you can't help yourself, you know? So you start to notice things that you see in trailers, like very clearly it's an adversarial relationship between Spider-Man 2099 and Miles Morales. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be what I assume is the primary conflict between the two. And I try really hard not to think too hard about movies before I go into them. And yeah. I got tricked into
thinking about this.
What do
you think about the multiple styles? I can't tell if that's just a splashy fun thing, or will we spend time in each one of these?
That would be a very good shorthand, and that would be consistent with the first movie. Because remember that the end tag after the credits was he goes back to Spider-Man 66 or whatever, and then they're both in that art style. So they wouldn't be breaking any rules. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The new trailer for The Matrix Resurrections shows a series of split screen comparisons of the first movie with the new one, while we hear Carrie-Anne Moss's voiceover from the original talking about deja vu, meaning that something has changed. There's a glitch in the Matrix. One intriguing pairing there is Agent Smith with the original Agent Smith with Yahu Abdul-Mateen, who is Morpheus in the new one. That's not usually the pairing I would think of. Also, the new Agent Smith, Jonathan Goff, is matched Keanu Reeves.
Neo?
Neo, thank you. when both of them have their mouths sealed shut. There's also a very unkempt Merovingian in there. There's a scene of what appears to be the machines fighting other machines instead of fighting humans. And there's a scene of the new Trinity split with Neo putting on his sunglasses and the new Trinity putting on sunglasses. All of this kind of saying like, hey, we're going to hit some beats from the original, but things have changed.
So when I watched this, it felt to me like a pitch that sort of spoke between the lines, asking, would you be cool if just, you know, we kept on doing Matrix stuff and they're all the same characters, but they kept on having different avatars forever and ever and ever and ever, and stuff got more and more interesting and weird in the Matrix. And the answer is yes. But having said that, again, this is another one, Tom. I know that you tend to be analytical and don't mind it. I this is a precious property that I try not to look directly at.
Yeah. I got you. I'm trying not to overinterpret this. I actually like that you're kind of, you know, down cycling it of like, hey, it's just a pitch of like, hey, do you like the Matrix? Would you like more Matrix? Here's a look at, you know, what the new Matrix will look like. Kind of don't read too much into it, because I'm definitely wanting to read more into it and do like, you know, Kremlinology and say like, ah, so Neo never actually fought. Maybe the entire fight of the first three movies was the simulation.
Well,
and now he's the real simulation. You know.
Oh, see, now you've got me. Now you've got me in it, Tom. Because all of a sudden, I can imagine what if the planet Earth got their act together and they went on to become happy and healthy, but we're seeing the story of essentially the World of Warcraft servers that are still running that nobody ever switched off.
There's all kinds of interesting ways it could go.
What are you doing to me, Tom? Don't.
Sorry.
God, you're making me look at the sun.
Well, we don't have much longer. It'll be out fairly soon. going back to Spider-Man, during press for Spider-Man No Way Home, the Tom Holland one, Kevin Feige said that if Daredevil were to appear in any future movies, and by the way, he was asked about this, so it doesn't mean Daredevil's going to show up in Spider-Man, although it doesn't not mean that either. But if Daredevil were to appear in any future movies, it would be played by Charlie Cox. Charlie Cox played Matt Murdock, aka Daredevil, in the Netflix series. Feige said that Charlie Cox would play any future occurrences of Daredevil and said, where we see that, how we see that, when we see that remains to be seen.
Now I will engage in this Kremlinology, this Marvelology. Kevin Feige was the one was present when they inked the deal to allow Netflix to cast this version of Daredevil.
Right.
In general, it seems like he is well pleased with how it turned out. So essentially all he's saying is, I was very pleased with how Daredevil turned out, and I would expect if you ever see a Daredevil again, it will be this one.
Yeah. I don't know enough to say whether it's Kevin Feige very cleverly saying, we have a contract with Charlie Cox.
Oh, shoot. So I didn't even think about that.
Wow. Ever put Matt Murdock in a movie, by golly, it'll be Charlie Cox. I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that there's a, you know, that I know that you know that I know with that reporter too. Like maybe there's a Daredevil appearance in this, in Spider-Man No Way Home. And Feige can't, you know, he wouldn't want to confirm that. So he says, where we see that, how we see that, when we see that remains to be seen, because nobody's seen Spider-Man No Way Home yet.
Man, that would be, I would be bummed if that turned out to be the case, because, No. I mean, I'll be thrilled to see him. I'll be sad that I'm looking at the sun. I don't want to look at the sun. It's bad for the eyes.
To me, it's just, you know, he could show up in Spider-Man No Way Home and I'll be like, ah, this is teasing a future you know, inclusion of him in a more substantive way.
Also, given the fact that the Netflix MCU stuff seems to be in a separate reality from everything else, although they do reference the events of Avengers in...
Yeah, they sort of very obliquely talk about, like, all that stuff that happened in New York.
The green guy and so on. Yeah. Man, that's interesting. If there was ever a movie,
that was all one way, too.
What's that?
That was all one way. It was like the Netflix stuff reference. It was not like the Avengers were talking about Daredevil.
Correct. But I guess what I'm saying is, if there's ever a single movie where, you know, anything goes and anyone could show up, it would be this movie that is being marketed as anything goes and anyone can show up.
There are multiple villains from multiple universes show up.
Right.
I wonder if that'll be it.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, you remember Netflix's one-off episode, Death to 2020? Last year?
I do.
It was like a funny riff on how awful 2020 was.
Yeah.
Well, there's a teaser for Death to 2021 coming December 27th. It's going to star Hugh Grant, Lucy Liu, Tracy Ullman, Samson Keo, Joe Keery, William Jackson Harper, Stockard Channing, Christy Milioti, Diane Morgan, Nick Muhammad, and more. The trailer is Diane Morgan joking around about Zoom dating.
Tom, I'll hold nothing back. I hate everything about this idea.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Death to 2020 was a cathartic and almost juvenile F you to the world for a genuinely terrible thing that happened to all of us. Institutionalizing it as an annual misery fest where just every year, that's what we're going to do is I am so over worst year ever. I am so over worst president ever. I'm so over worst governor ever. I'm so over all of it. I hate the idea and I don't intend to watch it.
I will watch it. I will watch it part with one foot in your universe of like, okay, 2021, definitely not like solving all the problems of 2020. I bet there's some fun stuff to poke fun at. What if next year it's thank you 2022 because we finally got out of all this stuff and it starts to become just a fun look back at the year.
There's only one way that happens. And if it's a live event hosted by Barack Obama, I will watch that. Thank you 2022. Oh, wow. Starring Barack Obama.
Yeah. Here's, I will watch Death to 2021. I will not watch Death to 2022. I will not be. I've got one more in me because I'm like, yeah, I mean, 2020 kind of bled into 21. So there might be some funny stuff in here. Let's take a look. But if it becomes a yearly, like, worst year ever kind of thing, I guess if it's really funny, maybe I'll get dragged in. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, I don't want it to always be like worst year ever.
It's the most cliche, dour 14-year-old. My daughter's 14. I found out thing, and I don't want to celebrate it.
Yeah, I'm with you. Although I can celebrate it one last time, just for this year. That's my thing. Proving it means it when it says it wants to have the widest variety of programming available, Netflix is turning a viral tweet into a series. If you're unfamiliar, in 2016, the Thanksgiving tweet was a real thing where someone's grandma accidentally texted a Thanksgiving invitation to the wrong person. And then she invited him anyway, and he showed up, and they tweeted screenshots of the whole conversation. The grandma's name is Wanda Dench, apparently still has Jamal Hinton over for Thanksgiving every year. They're friends. So they're going to make a TV show about it starring, well, we don't know who it's starring or directing, but Abdul Williams, who wrote the New Edition story and the Bobby Brown story, is on board to write it.
This is a fictionalized account or a documentary of the actual thing?
It is a fictionalized account, I believe.
Okay. So, sorry,
we'll
Hallmark
see.
Channel. Netflix has this one.
Yeah. The Thanksgiving tweet story.
Also, probably a ripoff of our Thanksgiving movie, Bryce.
Actually, I don't know. Bryce, do you know if the Bobby Brown story and the New Edition story, were they both... you don't happen to know whether they were both documentary style, do you?
Which ones?
Bobby Brown story and the New Edition story.
I don't know those. But the wording on this makes it sound like this will be fictional, drawing inspiration from viral online content.
Yeah. I figured that was the case. So.
Yeah, I don't know about the other ones though.
All right. Well, hey, tweets. Tweet something funny in your life, and you won't have a Netflix show because it's only happening.
Tweet something unfunny, and you will regret it forever. Hell of mistakes on that.
Never be able to. Let's get on to what we've been watching in the Eyes On section. And Brian and I both talking about the same thing, the Disney Plus three-part documentary Get Back, where Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame got permission from all four estates. Well, with Paul and Ringo, it was directly from them, but the estates of John Lennon and George Harrison to plow through the hundreds of hours of footage from the making of the movie that eventually became the Let It Be movie, which was released, I guess, in 1969 or 1970. This is an 8-hour adventure cut to show a lot more of what actually happened when those cameras were rolling over that several week period in January 1969.
Dude, the upscaling is amazing. The sound is incredible. It really does feel like you're right there. If you have a 4K TV, I'm sure it looks even better or whatever. I watched the first 2.5 hours of this with rapt attention, and I started the second 2.5 hours, and about an hour into it, I started playing Hearthstone and watching on the side, and in that last hour, maybe a little bit of Far Cry 6, I still was watching, still had 15 more minutes in episode 2, but I followed it along. I can't stop watching it. It's so real.
Yeah, Eileen and I started watching it, I guess, Friday night, and we finished it Saturday night. We definitely got sucked in.
Do they get back together at the end?
Spoiler, they do. It's an alternate universe. No, I definitely noticed what you're talking about, though. That first episode, I mean... Is it spoilery to talk about things that actually happened?
No, we get to talk about all of it.
That's as much of a warning as I'm going to give you. I mean, Paul and George have a knockdown, drag-out fight. You see Paul McCartney literally create the song Get Back while George yawns. You see John Lennon's being really weird with Yoko sitting right next to him. Linda goes and sits over in the corner when she comes in. Patty Harrison, same thing. Yoko always sitting right next to John. Doesn't say much in that first episode. It's fascinating. And George leaves the band, like literally quits the Beatles. And they're like, has this happened before? Like, well, it happened with Ringo once. He came back. And you can tell they're like kind of not sure. And they're planning, well, if he doesn't come back, I guess this. And we're like, oh my gosh, that's real. Like they are treating this as real. Fascinating. That second episode, they kind of get their stuff together. They've met with George. They've sort of worked it out. They go to the Apple studios. They're working in more comfortable surroundings. And so it becomes more of a fun look about how they actually created these songs, which is still interesting, but you don't have the drama. You don't have the weirdness of that first episode, which I think was made it so compelling.
The second episode, would I be out of school to say it felt almost more authentic? Because I think the fact that they were on a soundstage, the fact that they knew they were doing a thing caused everybody to have kind of amped up energies. And then they let go of the idea of a big show, of a big event, of a big everything. And instead it's like, all right, can we just make this album? And then I feel like in episode 2, you really feel like you're sitting in with them.
Yeah, it does. Because John Lennon starts joking around and talking a bunch, even though Yoko's still right there next to him, it doesn't feel as awkward as it did in that big studio in episode 1. And you can tell that they forget the cameras are on more often when they're in their recording studio. Although I don't know if you caught it a couple of times, they talk about how, this is nice because it's our place. Like it's the first time they've recorded there. This is not a place they've recorded before.
It's also for anybody well steeped in Beatles lore. I mean, it's like they always had an adult in the room with Brian Epstein, and you could hear them refer to Mr. Epstein, and there's kind of this desperate longing for somebody like I think at one point in episode 2, Paul says, I just wish there was a grown up to say, you got to show up at 9 a.m. and make the music and all that stuff.
In fact, I noticed Paul at one point says, we need a daddy. We need someone to tell us what to do. And then at another point saying, I don't think the Beatles need a manager. You know, like you could tell they're all, at least Paul, all over the place. Like on whether they want that or not, because I think they don't feel anyone could ever step into those shoes of Epstein.
I also adored that brief moment in episode 2 where Paul is talking about all the footage he got from their time with the Maharishi, and he's describing the shots and they're showing the shots and all that stuff. And meanwhile, there's kind of this eye rolling energy about like that guy, am I right? And how funny it was that we believed him or whatever. And then George Harrison, kind of serious, not serious, funny, not funny, is like, well, if any of you really found yourselves in there, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing now. You know, like, hey guys, that was a spiritual awakening,
like,
for
hey,
me.
I
and you're making light of it.
Yeah. And they very much backpedal of like, well, yeah.
It was a beautiful area.
And I'm like, there's so many things I think what makes the second, and I'll say the third episode as well, although you get a lot more of the rooftop concert in the third, there's so much about it that makes the Beatles human, right?
Right.
There's so much about it. The first episode's just weird because of the soundstage and the fight and George quitting the band. And that's kind of more what you might expect, you know, from some dramatic documentary. The second episode is more like anyone who's ever done a creative enterprise with friends knows all of these things that are happening. Right. You know, the petty spats, the collaboration, the goofing off, the, you know, getting weird, the tiptoeing around that one member of the group who's a little sensitive about that one thing we did. And, you know, let's not, you know, and it's not because they're trying to keep George in the group. You could tell, like, that's just a friend dynamic of like, oh, right, George, no, I know this is means different things to you than it does to us. And yeah, I watched all of that thinking like, man, I have been almost all of these people, even Ringo, the one who's just like, you know, I'll just start drumming when I think drumming is needed and I won't when there's not. And otherwise I, you know, kind of keep to myself. Like,
and again,
I've been in all those situations.
Yeah. You and I are not live musicians, but you and I are no strangers to the collaborative group dynamic. And that is the part that fascinated me so much about this whole thing. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good stuff. Get Back. I know a lot of you have already watched it, but if you haven't, hearing us tell you these things isn't the fun of watching it. Like soaking in it is the fun of watching it. I think even if you're not a Beatles fan, honestly, I was telling Bryce this before the show, I feel like what Peter Jackson did is he brought a modern reality show sensibility to all of this old footage and made a compelling story out of it.
Yeah.
All right, Bryce, what should we be on the lookout for?
Hey, we got a letter about our discussion last week on adaptations from Belissa, who writes, "Hi, Tom, Brian, and Bryce. I know your discussion of adaptations and remakes was more about doing another version of something that was already made into a movie or TV show, but I wanted to comment on a related idea, adapting a book or series of books. I'm very much enjoying Amazon's adaptation of The Wheel of Time. It's done with, in my opinion, exactly the right balance of being faithful to the books, especially who the characters are, their relationships, while still managing to surprise fans who have read the books. For me, there's been at least one gasp out loud moment each episode. I think there were 3 in episode 5. This balance of the familiar and the new twist is going to be a key factor in the success of the series, I think. Belissa. If you, like me, thank you, Belissa, for the letter. If you, like me, don't know Wheel of Time or you missed all of the hubbub about it, it is a medieval fantasy epic set in this world of magic. There's a powerful magic user who's from a group of women, and only the women use magic there. And she takes 4 young people on a journey to see if they are the reincarnation of a magical entity that can destroy a coming evil. So it looks pretty cool. I'm not in a fantasy epic headspace right now, but it seemed very well done, the bit that I saw. There are going to be 8 episodes of The Wheel of Time this season. They are releasing new episodes weekly. They should all be out by the end of the year. That's on Amazon Prime Video. Tom and Brian, any interest in The Wheel of Time?
If there's one thing I know about it, as somebody who hasn't read it, is that it is famous for being very long.
Yes.
And there was this great moment because Bonnie is in the middle of reading all of the books on audiobook. And so I walked into...
There's like 20 books, right? There's a ton of books.
There's a lot of them. So I walked in and I hear, I know she's been listening to it and I know she's getting near the end. And I walk in and I just hear her iPhone go... epilogue. And I go, oh, and she goes, "You wish." So I am not familiar. I have not read, but it's been fun to watch somebody else read it.
Yeah, we read the first book for Sword and Laser years and years ago when Robert Jordan was still alive. And famously, Robert Jordan did not live to finish the series, but Brandon Sanderson was, with Robert Jordan's cooperation, engaged to write the final book, which only came out a few years ago. So this is a beloved series. I absolutely intend to dive in. I just haven't gotten it fit into the schedule yet. But I've been hearing nothing but good things from the people who adore this series. So
I will vouch on Bonnie's behalf that she really enjoyed hearing Brandon Sanderson's voice come out in the last books. She's a big fan.
Nice. And like I said, these are coming out every week on Amazon Prime Video, but I believe they're all supposed to be done right about Christmas time. So if you're looking for something to binge over the holidays, that might be something to look out for. If you've got something we should be on the lookout for, email it to us, please, cordkillers@gmail.com. Thank you.
Ah, this Friday was the triumphant return, Brian.
The triumphant return? Who came home?
I did, to my newsletter that I hadn't done in 2 weeks.
I didn't know you were gone. Were you held in prison? Because I went to freetomnewsletter.com. I was afraid that you'd been put in prison.
Exactly. Thank you for going. It freed me to write a new version of Free Tom Newsletter at freetomnewsletter.com. This is great. I'm really getting in the groove. I've got some great responses from people out there, and it's a chance for me to tell you a little something about what's on my mind. I've been doing a little more of that, a little more writing about what's on my mind. This week, it's all about the great guest episodes that I had. I appeared on Allison Sheridan's Chit Chat Across the Pond. I appeared on Andrew Heaton's Alienating the Audience and more. So, go check it out. It's a little bit of my thoughts, a little bit of what I've been up to, all at freetomnewsletter.com.
And of course, this is the time of year we want to remind you, if you're about to get a new computer, get it from doghousesystems.com/rogue. Use promo code rogue at checkout. You get some extra stuff. You'll be getting us out of hock with our friends over at Doghouse Systems.
Let's move on to the front lines.
Front lines.
Fox started a cable channel and called it FX. FX used to just be called FX. Then it became FX and FXX. Then it became FX, FXX, and after Disney bought it, FX on Hulu. FX shows referred to those on the cable network, while FX on Hulu shows referred to the originals made by FX for Hulu, but also any of the cable network shows available on Hulu. But now, they've changed it. If you watch an FX show on Hulu, whether it was on the cable network or made exclusively for Hulu, it will be called an FX show. They're dropping the on Hulu. The hub will no longer be called FX on Hulu, just FX. However, if you find an FX show on Hulu and you can't find it on the cable channel, it's because it's an original made for Hulu, but it's still just called an FX show when it's on Hulu. Questions?
And just in case anybody under the age of 21 is listening, if you do any searching, don't search for F space XXX. That's not going to get you.
Entirely different thing. Good point.
The delayed Netflix is a Joke Festival from 2020 has been scheduled to finally take place in LA on April 29th, May 8th, 2022. The idea, or I guess from one to the other, the idea is that more than 100 acts associated with Netflix are going to perform live at comedy clubs around LA, as well as larger venues like Dodger Stadium and the Hollywood Bowl. The acts will be filmed, they're also going to make specials during it for Netflix. Headliners include Dave Chappelle, Amy Schumer, Tina Fey, Wanda Sykes, Jerry Seinfeld, David Letterman, Chris Rock, Ali Wong, Hasan Minhaj, am I pronouncing that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Ronnie Chang, and the Beatles.
Seriously, the surviving Beatles. I mean, kind of brilliant for Netflix to be like, we're putting on comedy specials around LA. Also, filming all of our next 2 years worth of comedy specials in one fell swoop.
Earlier today, we talked about on DTNS the Spotify situation with differentiating the jokes that are written from the performance of the jokes that are written and rights for each. Mm. I feel like this is going to play into that, and whether or not all of a sudden people are going to say like, oh, no, Netflix, you have the rights to that performance, but I'm going to need double royalties for the jokes.
Yeah, they would have to lock that all up in the contract ahead of time. I'm the way Spotify has, because remember, Spotify has the right to show it. It's just that the rights group wants to change the deal.
I'm just saying, pray they don't alter it further.
Yeah. Live in front of a studio audience, where they take classic TV shows from Norman Lear and Jimmy Kimmel help put them on, is returning Tuesday, December 7th, with live presentations of an episode of Different Strokes and an episode of Facts of Life. Now, we heard the cast of Different Strokes before, which included Anne Dowd as Mrs. Garrett. She was on both of the series. The Facts of Life is going to star Jennifer Aniston as Blair, Gabrielle Union as Tootie, Alison Tolman as Natalie, and Catherine Hahn as Joe.
Tom, have we watched any of these?
I watched the very first round that they did, where they did All in the Family and the Jeffersons. That was super fun.
How much of it lives in the moment as a novel, electric, oh my gosh, this is happening right now? And how much of it survives as, I'm so glad this is recorded because I can't wait to visit it or share it with a friend?
Yeah, I didn't watch either one of them live, but they preserved all of the live elements. And there were a couple of interesting live moments that you might expect. And there's a lot of really interesting... That plays a whole lot differently now than it used to, which you might expect. Also, that plays a whole lot differently with Woody Harrelson in that part than it would with the original characters. So I think this is really interesting to take. I think they chose people as experienced. Don't forget, like, I think it's Kevin Hart is playing Arnold, right? Like, they're not casting children. Yeah. They're casting experienced actors in these parts, and I think that's fascinating.
Channing Tatum will return for a third Magic Mike movie being made by HBO Max, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Reed Carlin, who wrote the first two, will also write this one. This one will be an HBO Max exclusive and appears to be an attempt to wrap up the story.
Ah, the Magic Mike trilogy.
To wrap that rascal.
They say it's going to wrap up the story, but I bet Steven Soderbergh and Channing Tatum decide to make prequels.
No, if you go too far, then it becomes a crime.
Redbox will start running ads on some of its DVD kiosks in the United States. More than 2,000 kiosks already have digital signage that they can use to do this. They expect to have about 4,000 kiosks all told showing ads eventually. Movie studios will be the main target, so you're probably going to see a lot of trailers for the things you could rent right there. But they also might be doing it like they do at the gas station with some national and local stuff.
So I have no doubt that Redbox thinks this is a big deal, and maybe the people buying the ads think it's a big deal, but those numbers don't strike me as a tremendous, like,
depends on the number of people that visit each kiosk, right? 4,000 kiosks doesn't sound like a lot, but if these are the 4,000 most trafficked kiosks,
right,
each one with 10,000 a day,
500 then, people per day and so on, and they're all impulse buying, then maybe that does move the needle. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. It starts to it really does remind me of those gas pumps that have the video that, you know, like, show you the weather and then show you an ad and then show you some news and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, no, like, I was going to gas up my Jeep and all of a sudden the video screen said, what are you, regular guy? You're going to use regular gas or are you going to use premium gas? And I was like, I'm a premium guy.
Yeah, it happens a lot when you try to rent Dante's Peak. What, you're a regular guy?
Why'd you a volcano guy? Google TV added Pluto TV to its live grid for the For You tab. All the devices running the Google TV OS will get the addition over the next few weeks. Google TV also features Tubi and Xumo in its free TVs and TV apps to download now.
All right, let's get to the dispatches from the front.
More like Red Notice Box.
It's kind of the one
Got
thing
an
it can't
email.
Be.
Got an email from Andrew, your patron. Is this even the name for someone who supports you on Patreon? Yes, it is. Patron. Thank you, Andrew. Tom, Brian, and Bryce. First, Boba Fett wanting to take over for Jabba fits in my opinion. I'm a lifelong Star Wars fan, but never got into the legend books, so I know who Salacious Crumb is, but I'd be hard-pressed to name Leia and Han's three kids. This is what I know about Boba. He was traumatized at a young age when he watched Mace Windu behead his father. As an orphan during Star Wars Clone Wars, his character flip-flopped a lot. Sometimes he was an angry kid looking for revenge. Sometimes he was trying to get rich with some bounty hunters. To me, it also felt like he was a kid looking for a home. By the time we get to Empire and Return of the Jedi, it seems like he has found his home. He delivered Han. Why stick around with Jabba? I just kind of assumed he finally found his home. With that said, I think it's fitting that he would want to take over once Jabba is gone. Why it took so long, I have no idea, but I'm interested in watching. Probably has to do with being digested in the Sarlacc pit. But second, my question for Brian. Does he really not know what show is first on Spoiler in Time? At first, oh, this on Spoiler in Time, Brian is always asking me, which show should we start with? Andrew says, at first I thought it was part of the script for him to ask what was first, but
thank you for asking
like
this,
really,
Andrew. I would also like to know very much.
Is this an act? Because if it is, you're a much better actor than I would have thought. Start doing VO work.
Okay, two things. First of all, I put this in here because I really appreciate that you never know what you can't see from your perspective. And I'm somebody who loved all the Expanded Universe books. And of course, Boba Fett is portrayed differently in the books than in what is quote unquote canon. I never watched Clone Wars. So as a result, I thought it was really interesting that what to me sounded ridiculous, the idea that Boba Fett is a galaxy trotting bounty hunter who wanted to become the mayor of, you know, Katy, Texas, seemed weird, but to him, it seems like it made sense. I thought that was cool. And spoiler alert, every time during the break, I go to the bathroom, so I literally don't know what order you guys set stuff up in. Yes, it's in the doc, I understand. I also don't look at the doc because I've done the real work, which is thinking about all my hot takes about what I'm going to say.
Sure, but you have the doc.
Hi, Tom, Brian, Bryce, guests. We got a good review. I don't think we have time for it.
No, you know what? What I will say about Josh. Josh, thank you. Josh wrote a great like roundup of his experience with the Fire TV, the NVIDIA Shield, Roku, LG WebOS, Google TV, Xbox, PS5, and Apple TV. It's we'll put the whole thing in the show notes, but the Apple TV is Josh's recommendation. Even though he's tried all of those, it's probably the priciest streaming box, and you get what you pay for. Apps are clean and uniform, very few bugs in the system, multitasking where you can actually have multiple apps open and switch between them. Yes, some apps, I'm looking at you, Peacock, don't use Apple's standard video player, but all of them use the scrubber and the forward and back on the remote. Siri can search across apps as well. If someone asked me today, I would say folks should go for the Apple TV and then the Roku, unless they have built-in TV apps. That would be third. But otherwise, I wouldn't recommend it.
That sounds accurate in my experience. My very, very limited experience with the Apple TV is that it's got more horsepower than I've ever experienced on any version of the Roku.
I'm with Josh. If your TV has apps built in and you don't want to spend any more money, use them. They're perfectly serviceable, as he says in his reviews that he sent us. The Roku is the budget pick of like, yeah, it's really good. And the Apple TV is like, if you don't mind spending, you know, a little extra money, you're going to get a little what you pay for. I'm totally with you on that, Josh. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that is it for us. Our website is cordkillers.com. Our email address is cordkillers@gmail.com. We are live on twitch.tv/nightattack, which is also carried on diamondclub.tv Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. We'll talk to you next time.
Hey, Tom Merritt, what's going on?
I'm just hanging out here watching this scroll go by. What are you doing?
Trying to set up a bit where we thank our beautiful, beautiful patrons, all these wonderful names.
I'm sorry, I'm too distracted looking at these beautiful, beautiful patron names going by. Look at that one. I mean, if you wanted to be one of these people, patreon.com/cordkillers would be the place to go.
I mean, they're scratching our itch, like, because we're addicted.
As long as it's consensual, like,
we're addicted to their money.
And love. Might as well face it.
Well, God damn it.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.